Hello, Capital Region. Welcome back to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on Wednesday, May 20th. I'm Alexis Goldsmith.
Rhea Cunliffe, hello. Well, we start off with an interview with Howard Hawkins, who won the Green Party presidential primary in New York State last Saturday.
And then we hear from Assembly Health Committee Chair Richard Gottfried on investigating nursing homes' response to COVID-19.
And later on, we talk to Rick Carlin of the Albany Times Union on his reporting on the Norlite incinerator in Cohoes.
After that, we have a segment about job hunting and graduating during the COVID-19 crisis.
Finally, a community event this weekend in Troy will provide a no-cost personal protective equipment and a barbecue meal. And here come some headlines.
The Wall Street Journal reported that the Norlite incinerator in Cohoes secretly burned more than 2 million pounds of toxic firefighting foam containing PFAS from 25 states. The city of Cohoes recently enacted a one-year moratorium on the burning of such materials, though earlier this week, the Department of Defense sought to force Norlite to accept another shipment of the toxic material.
The Rensselaer City Board of Education voted unanimously Monday night to have a proposed tax levy increase of 19.5% for the 2020-21 school year, drawing down its financial reserves to avoid an even larger tax hike. The district originally considered a 24.5% increase as part of a long-term effort to restore fiscal stability. The Rensselaer City School District is attempting to restore its finances following an 11% tax levy drop as part of the 2017-2018 school budget, which was based on a miscalculation of the district's financial health.
Governor Cuomo said that Memorial Day events this weekend will be limited to 10 people practicing social distance and scaled back vehicles only in parades.
And the good government of Common Cause says that legislatures should agree to cut their $110,000 salaries in half unless they resume work remotely on legislation, while lawmakers argue they're working hard to help constituents deal with the COVID-19. Common Cause argue that their job under the state constitution is to pass legislation, not just do social work. The state Senate announced late Tuesday that they will convene for 2 days next week. The Vermont state legislature has continued to function throughout the COVID-19 crisis.
The Albany Times Union reports that confirmed coronavirus cases in homeless shelters across the capital region remain low, but many people are avoiding congregate settings amid fears they could contract the virus. The Albany Outreach Van reports they are helping 75 homeless people a day, which is triple their normal number. Shelters have implemented precautions to reduce the spread of the virus.
And the 8 counties of the capital region began phase 1 of reopening on Wednesday. Phase 1 involves businesses that have the least potential for spread of the virus. That is construction, agriculture, forestry, pickup drop-off retail, manufacturing, and wholesale trade. All intervals of at least 2 weeks, other business sectors will be allowed to reopen in phases 2, 3, and 4. And for those of you just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOCLP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOSLP 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOALP 106.9 FM Albany, and WCAALP 107.3 FM Albany, coming from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York.
Our first segment tonight, Howie Hawkins won 80% of the vote in the Green Party virtual nominating convention for New York on Saturday, May 16th. Mark Dunley talks with Howie about his campaign.
We're talking with Howie Hawkins, who is seeking the Green Party nomination for president. New York State had its, primary nominating convention this weekend, and Howie won 80% of the vote and the number of delegates to go with that to the national convention. So Howie, congratulations, but how is the nomination looking at this point? And I believe it ends up in July 11th with a virtual convention?
Yeah, July 11th, we have a online convention instead of being in Detroit, which we had originally planned. And the nomination's going well. I have a 3-1 lead over the second place candidate. I've won 19 of 20 primaries. And I'm getting ready to run in the general election at this point. I'm not there yet, but I think we'll get over the finish line here pretty quick.
Now, I understand you are hopefully getting close to qualifying for primary matching funds, which I believe is getting $5,000 in at least 20 different states, no more than $250 for any particular candidate. How is that shaping up? And also, how is the COVID-19 crisis impacting upon petitioning and trying to get on the ballot?
Well, matching funds, we hope to wrap up qualification in the next couple of weeks. And what that means is everybody who contributes to us in cumulative donations up to $250 will have their donations matched by the Federal Election Commission, which will basically double the amount of money we've raised. And it'll be worth at least $200,000 because that's where we're at now. And we'll pour that back into ballot access, because we're aiming to get on all 51 ballots, 50 states in the District of Columbia. So the matching funds is going well. We're the only campaign in the country that's going for it. The major party candidates won't go for it because if you accept that money, you can't spend over $50 million on your primary. And that's not enough for the major party candidates. And then the alternative parties, none of the campaigns seem to be strong enough to even come close to qualifying. So we'll probably be the only campaign this year that qualifies. And as far as the coronavirus lockdown affecting us, I'm actually probably talking to more people one-on-one through Zoom and Skype and StreamYard. And I just was on a new one called Blue Jeans. And I'm talking, 15 to 100 people, two or three, four times a day. And instead of, getting in the car and driving half a day or getting on an airplane across the country, I'm getting people online. So in a way, it's working out well for us. And I enjoy meeting people face to face. That's a lot of fun and it's a better connection, but online is what we got and we're doing it.
Now, one of the news releases that we've actually put out Friday right before the New York State convention was the concern that as Congress is reacting and trying to respond to the COVID-19 crisis and the economic shutdown, they haven't really been doing enough to sort of embrace the concept of a Green New Deal or a green economic stimulus, which actually has been pretty prevalent in other places like Europe and South Korea.
Yeah, we have the two governing parties are blundering blindly, and they are presiding over a failed state. We have 4% of the world's population, and we have 30% of its COVID infections and deaths. And we are plunging into a depression unlike any other country in the world. In Europe, in terms of short-term remedies, they basically protected the payrolls of companies. So they're frozen in place until they can reopen, and people are attached to their employers. And they're getting income so they can pay the rent or the mortgage or whatever it is, buy food and that kind of thing. In this country, we have, according to an analysis by the National Jobs for All Coalition, we're already at 26% unemployment when you count people working both part-time one and full-time work, and people who are discouraged and aren't counted in the Bureau of Labor Statistics accounting. So that's greater than the Great Depression. And small businesses account for nearly half of the jobs in this country, and nearly half of the small businesses had less than a month's cash reserves. We've been on lockdown now for 7 weeks. And when you're out of cash and you're a small business, you're dead. So those businesses and the jobs, millions of jobs with them, have disappeared. And so this is just inexcusable. They don't have a decent healthcare response, and they are relying solely on private enterprise to get us out of this economic recovery. But consumers, to the extent they still have cash, are holding on for essentials. And investors are not going to invest in that risky environment. So we are headed for a long-term economic depression. That's where the Green New Deal comes in. What the plan that I have put forward, and I put forward a detailed budget on HowieHawkins.us, our website, we're calling for a $27.5 trillion 10-year program of public enterprise and planning to convert all our productive systems to 100% clean energy and zero to negative greenhouse gas emissions by 2030, because that's what the climate science carbon budgets say rich countries like the United States need to do if we're going to avert the worst consequences of climate change. And we're getting nothing from these two governing parties in that regard. They just have stopgap measures. On Friday, they passed the so-called HEROES Act, which I call the Cowards Act. That was the Democrats in the House. It was Pelosi's bill. And they left out the kind of relief that they're providing in Europe, where their unemployment rate is a fraction of ours. Bernie Sanders on the Senate side and Pramila Jayapal on the House side had a bill called the Payroll Protection Act, which would do what they do in Europe. And that is pay the payrolls of these companies that are locked down for the duration so they can reopen and get going where they were, and people have money to spend. We're not doing anything like that. So, you know, there's some good things in that bill, you know, the money for the post office, money for state and local government, money for mail-in ballots, which we need to have a real election. But overall, it is not up to the task. So I think this is an opportunity for the Green Party. You know, we can point in the direction of a Green New Deal, a full-strength Green New Deal. And that's the road to economic recovery as well as climate safety.
We're talking with Howie Hawkins, seeking the Green Party nomination for president. Recently you announced that if you do win the Green Party nomination, you would like to have Angela Walker, African-American truck driver now from, South Carolina, I guess, where she grew up with, but actually been an active union person candidate previously, maybe in Milwaukee, but maybe tell us a little bit about Angela.
Well, she's a lifelong labor and racial justice activist, going back to high school when she organized Black students to get a Black history class in their high school there in Milwaukee. And she became a public transit bus driver. And when the Wisconsin uprising rose up, when Governor Scott Walker tried to destroy the collective bargaining rights of public unions, teachers and other unions in the public sector, even though transit workers were exempted, she organized her local, of which she became the legislative director, to participate in the Wisconsin uprising in the first half of 2011. And then got the union involved in Occupy in Milwaukee, in Occupy the Hood, which tried to get Black people in particular involved in the Occupy movement. And as a result of that, people asked her to run for sheriff of Milwaukee as an independent socialist against David Clark, who people may have seen on TV, particularly Fox News, the cowboy hat wearing sheriff who Trump wanted to put in Homeland Security, but he was so crazy they couldn't even accept him. And he was running on a platform of don't call 911, get a gun. So her platform was fight crime and violence by fighting poverty. And she got 20% of the vote. And I met her, that was 2014. I met her at a panel. I was running for governor here in New York on the Green Party line. She was running for sheriff. And then I was on a panel again with her the next year about independent left politics. So I've known her since then. And I know she's somebody that will make a good teammate. We have good rapport. She's a great speaker. She presents the issues in an understandable way with a conviction that people feel. So I'm just very happy she agreed to be my running mate.
Well, let me just jump in here. So I've been talking to Howie Hawkins, HowieHawkins.us, Green Party, seeking the nomination, Green Party for president. This has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
And thank you, Mark. That was the Green Party National Convention that will take place on July 11th. On Tuesday, the courts ruled that the Democratic presidential primary in New York will take place on June 23rd, overruling efforts by the Board of Elections to cancel it.
In our next segment, Mark Dunley, again, talked with Assembly Health Committee Chair Richard Gottfried concerning his call for an independent investigation into nursing homes and COVID-19.
We're talking with Assemblymember Richard Gottfried, the longtime chair of the New York State Assembly Health Committee, also the longtime sponsor of New York Health, a single-payer proposal in New York State. But today we're talking to Assemblymember Gottfried about his recent op-ed in the New York Post, pointing out that we've had at least 5,574 deaths in nursing homes from the COVID-19 crisis. And he feels that we need an independent investigation, not just to have the governor and the attorney general look into matters. So, Assemblymember, why do you think an independent investigation is needed here?
Well, first of all, a lot of the responsibility for what's going on in our nursing homes is not only on the nursing home operators, but on the state, on the state itself. We have, you know, for decades, the state has done nothing about the serious understaffing in our nursing homes. The state's inspection staff has, for decades, been understaffed itself. The state's enforcement efforts are lax at best. Most of the revenue that nursing homes survive on or operate on is Medicaid revenue, and we have chronically underfunded that. And so a lot of the responsibility is on the state. Now, Attorney General Tish James is terrific. She does a great job, but her main relationship to the health department is that she is their lawyer when they get sued. You can't count on either the health department to investigate itself or the attorney general as their lawyer to investigate them. And so what needs to happen is the attorney general needs to bring in what is called an outside counsel, which is often done in cases where it is legally inappropriate for the attorney general herself to be handling a case, to do a very thorough professional investigation of how we got here, what's going on now, and most importantly, what we need to change tomorrow and in the future.
So has the attorney general or, you know, the governor responded to your call for this idea about bringing in an outside counsel?
Well, it's interesting. I have not heard any response from either the executive branch, the governor, the health department, nor from the attorney general. And, you know, I've been in the press talking about this for a week or more. It's interesting that it's gotten a lot of public attention, certainly, and a lot of my legislative colleagues are on board with it. So far, I've had no response from the governor or from the attorney general.
Now, one of the things you've pointed out is the issue of the nursing homes tend to be seriously understaffed, and you make reference to the problems with Medicaid funding, which counts about 80% of the patients in nursing homes have Medicaid funding. But you also note that the Department of Health has actually opposed efforts by the state legislature to establish minimum standards for staffing at these nursing homes. Why would the health department, governor basically, do that?
Well, that's a fair question. And yeah, the safe staffing bill, I first put that bill in the late 1990s. It has very strong support from, as you might imagine, from the unions representing the workers in the nursing homes. It would apply to hospitals as well. But the industry, and the hospitals strongly oppose it, which I guess is no surprise, because they would be obligated to hire more staff. The executive branch has always consistently opposed this. They argue, well, you know, it would cost Medicaid more money. Yes, it would. You know, if crime goes up, we spend more money on police. Nobody says we shouldn't. You know, if there are more fires, we hire more firefighters. If we've got problems in our nursing homes with understaffing, we need to pay for more staff. Lives depend on it. The proposal has been in the assembly's budget package from year to year, and it is always strongly opposed by the governor. In the 2019 budget, the governor's people agreed to do a study with a working group about staffing needs in hospitals and nursing homes. Working group was formed. It did its study. The report was supposed to be published in December of 2019. We're now about 6 months later, and there is still no sign of any kind of report. And I think that tells you the attitude of the health department.
So, you know, what can New York State do better at this moment to protect residents of nursing homes? The governor did rescind at least a portion of his executive order that said nursing homes had to take patients being discharged from hospitals that had COVID-19, but I still believe they had to take other COVID-19 patients. He's done, you know, some stuff with respect to testing, but are our nursing home patients adequately protected at this moment?
I don't think so. And let me stress again, this is not something new. Our nursing home patients, residents, have been in jeopardy for decades. You know, every several times a year, different national groups put out studies comparing the nursing homes in different states about their quality measures and number of patients with bed sores, et cetera. And, you know, we like to think we're New York, we must be the best. Actually, New York's nursing homes are pretty consistently towards the bottom. So yes, our nursing home residents are in jeopardy. The state needs to, you know, on the question of patients coming out of hospitals, you know, a hospital bed is expensive. They are in scarce supply. And, you know, it's kind of obvious. Hospitals are filled with sick people. If you don't need to be in a hospital, you want to go somewhere else. And people who need to be in a nursing home should not be just sent back to, you know, to where they had been living before, nor is it really good for them to be kept in a hospital. They do belong in a nursing home bed, but that nursing home needs to have the rules and the funding and the professionalism to keep those COVID patients separated and properly cared for. And the state was not insisting on that. They are just now beginning to try to set up some COVID-19 only nursing facilities. And that's long overdue. But I think an independent study would document for us staffing needs in the nursing homes, staffing needs within the health department itself, a change in culture both in nursing homes and in the health department's enforcement effort that is needed, and certainly an increase in the funding that we put into all of this. And, you know, yeah, the state is in terrible fiscal shape, particularly because of COVID-19. But there are still a lot of millionaires and billionaires in New York State. New York has extraordinary wealth, more than any state in the union. And that wealth needs to be called upon to pay a slightly higher share of its wealth in taxes to help support healthcare and education and paving the state's roads and all those other things that our lives depend on.
So we've been talking with Assemblymember Richard Gottfried, Chair of the Assembly Health Committee, about the issue of nursing home. This has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network. Assemblymember, 20 seconds, if people want to do anything about this issue, what can they do at this point?
Write a letter to your local paper. Write to the governor. Write to your state legislators. Speak up every way you know how.
Thank you very much.
And that was part of Hudson Mohawk Magazine's ongoing coverage of the COVID-19 crisis.
If you're just tuning in, I'm Alexis Goldsmith. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, airing on WOOC-LP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOS-LP 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOA-LP 106.9 FM Albany, and WCAA-LP 107.3 FM Albany. And we're broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, except for Andrea, who's on her couch, I'm sure.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org.
Up next, earlier today, I interviewed Rick Carlin of the Times Union, who broke the story on Monday about the tanker trucks filled with firefighting foam that were scheduled to head to Cohoes despite the burn moratorium. This was the conversation that we had. Welcome to the show, Rick.
How you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Good.
Before we get into that story, can you talk about how the Times Union is able to support investigative journalism during COVID?
Well, we just have the reporters that are working on stories. We're still doing what we normally do. The only difference is that we're doing it from home instead of from our newsrooms. So we're all pretty much working on stories. I mean, one of the big, you know, the difference is that so many of us are doing a lot of our stories are relating to the pandemic. Okay. Not the normal beats, although we still are covering some of the beats that we do, but a lot of the stories I've been doing, for instance, are pandemic related. However, of course, the Norlite story is an ongoing story of interest to a lot of people. So when I found out about that, I jumped on that one. So we switched back and forth a little bit between the beats, but certainly in terms of, you know, investigating stories, there's really not a whole lot of difference in a lot of ways. We're still working away. We're just working from our homes, on our laptops and with our cell phones. And, you know, there's not the, face-to-face kind of collaboration you get with, you know, bouncing ideas off of editors and that sort of thing. But, you know, we have Slack, we have Zoom, we have cell phones. So we're still keeping in touch with one another.
Do you have any insight as to how your audience has been affected? You know, have you been able to retain your audience, or have the numbers changed?
The numbers online are up. People, they want to know about the pandemic. We've dropped the paywall for pandemic related news, which a lot of papers have done. And the readership numbers that I've seen are higher. The people are just, they're tuning in and they're hungry for every little bit of news about this pandemic, which I believe also filters out in the other aspects of the paper, where people now will start getting back into the habit of reading the paper online.
So,
you know, to do that, you need a subscription, but it's, you know, it's like a couple dollars a month or something. It's very inexpensive.
Can you talk about just briefly the importance of supporting local media and local journalism?
Oh, it's vital. I mean, without that, you don't know what's going on. I mean, you take the Norlite story, for example, that your folks are interested in as well. You know, you've got a company that is talking about burning and incinerating, you know, potentially toxic material. This would not have been known had it not been for the news reporting about this. The state knew that this was happening, but they didn't tell the city about it. The city had no idea until they just kind of stumbled. Somehow they got word of it, but without the media, whether it's newspapers, TV, radio, to disseminate this information, the people living in Cohoes probably wouldn't have any idea, or the people living downwind from Cohoes might not have any idea at all that this was an issue. So, I mean, there's an example right there. I mean, without local media, how are you going to know what's happening with the pandemic? Whether you can go back to work, whether your business can open up again? Where do you go for nuts and bolts information? Like, where do you get tested? How do you get help with your unemployment check? That sort of thing as well.
So the story came out on Monday that the tankers were going to be expected on Tuesday. Later that same day, you released a follow-up that they were actually going to hold off on that. First, can you talk about the power of the media in changing the outcome of this story?
Well, yeah, I think the story helped, not to use a term, but it helped slow down, or maybe it helped stop the shipment of the material. You know, that there was there was what they called, and there was an incineration order from the Department of Defense saying, okay, Norlight, come get these as per our contract. We've got these 58,000 gallons of AFFF for you to come get. We're looking for you to come pick them up and bringing them up there the week of the, will be the April, this week, week of May 19th. We did a story on it. The wheel started turning. People started making calls. The Schumer's office was aware of this. Any government, most government, I shouldn't say all, but a lot are utterly immune. But most government agencies are somewhat sensitive to public reaction to things like that. And especially so when you've got a senator or a congressman or congresswoman saying, you know, hold off on this, because, you know, it's the elected officials who are ultimately the ones who set the budgets for these agencies. So they can have a lot of influence over these agencies, for better or worse. So in this case, I think that the media publicity around it at least delayed, if not stopped for a while, these shipments of AFFF, firefighting foam.
In your most recent article, you say that the shipments were actually scheduled for a week ago, starting on May 11th, but the story only broke on two days ago. How did you find out? Why was that?
Well, we had some sources tell us about these scheduled shipments. I'll leave it at that.
Last night, Assemblymember John McDonald held an environmental justice issues webinar where people could ask questions about issues, and the topic of Norlight came up, and he mentioned your article. Could I just play the clip right now and give you a chance to respond?
Yeah, I saw it. I watched it. Yeah.
Now, Norlight, the president, who I've now known for about 9 years, Sergio, yesterday there was a little bit of a dust up. As you know, there was an article reported in the Times Union that there was word that 12 truckloads or 58,000 gallons of this material was coming to Cohoes to be burned. President, I called him and within 30 seconds responded back and said, I'm aware of this story too. It's not true. We have no way of knowing where this came from. We would know if it was coming because either they would be contracted to go pick it up or they would have been notified that it's coming their way. So I have to think that was a false alarm, but it's a reminder that this could kick up at any time.
There were memos going back and forth within the Defense Logistics Agency and others, as well as some of the federal politicians, about this burn order that had gone. I'm sorry, this incineration order that had gone to DEC, saying that they are planning to have this material shipped. I believe it was starting on the 15th of May and arriving by possibly on the 19th, which would have been Tuesday. So, yeah, that's true. I mean, that was a factual story in terms of the shipments actually happening. No, that didn't happen. It kind of got derailed, really, once the story came out there, was out there.
This story now making national news, PFAS getting a lot of attention across the country. You know, AFFF is just one issue. What are some of the major obstacles to reporting on this issue, to getting the answers that the public deserves, and major obstacles to investigative journalism?
Well, it gets complicated. I mean, the AFFF contains various varieties of PFAS. And there are dozens of iterations of the PFAS, you know, different molecular configurations of this. they all might be regulated differently if they get end up getting regulated at all. Part of the problem is because it's essentially at this point is not really regulated, kind of like you would see with PCBs or DDT. It's hard to get, data sheets and statistics on how prevalent it is. That makes it difficult. And the other part of it is that PFAS, the more we're learning about them, it's quite prevalent. It's used in a lot of applications. You know, there's firefighting, there's fire departments all over the country. And a lot of them might have barrels of this foam lying around. It's an effective fire suppressant. They have them on airports. They have them on military bases. This 58,000-gallon shipment that we wrote about that was supposed to be coming to Cohoes but didn't, that was just from one naval station in Virginia, one naval station alone. They're turning up traces of the PFAS and AFFF in little towns like Cairo, New York, which is just south of us. There was an area where firefighters used to practice putting out fires, and they used the foam. Now that there's residue of the foam, and they're worried that it could could seep into the drinking water if they're not careful. So it's a fairly ubiquitous material. The PFOS in Hoosick Falls, which is east of Troy, right, in eastern Rensselaer County, east of you guys, they had a big problem with the water contamination. That was from using anti-stick surfaces that goes into Teflon. I'm told that the area around Hoosick Falls, New York, was once known as Teflon Valley because there were a number of facilities, factories there, that manufactured this chemical that went into Teflon. So that makes it, that makes it difficult. Where do you start looking? And what do you look for? And then there's, it's really sort of an unknown exactly what the health impacts are also. An epidemiologist from 3M told me, there's been no clear cut indication of death from PFAS. And technically, he may be right in terms of that it's been indicated or recorded by the government, but they do seem to have a lot of problems in Hoosick Falls with it. There have been health issues that have come up that people are linking to the PFOS. So there's the other question. So it's a matter of finding where these chemicals are. It's a matter of, okay, to what extent are they causing health problems in people? Most of what we know now with the PFOS are the parts per billion in the blood of people. They do testing in the blood. And for instance, the people in Hoosick Falls had much, much, much higher concentrations of PFOS in their blood than the average American. I guess most of us have some level of this in our blood. That's how ubiquitous it is.
Based on your information from your sources, the documents that you've seen, do you see any possibility at this time that Norlite could become a storage facility for this foam?
That's a good question that I've been wondering. I don't really know. It's an aggregate plant, so they have trucks going back and forth with full of gravel that they're putting in their kiln to create aggregate, which goes into roads and that sort of thing. Do they have the ability, for instance, to store 12 tankers of AFFF foam on their property? Do they have the space for that? And B, do they want to do that? I'm not sure that the contract calls for that. I think the contract talks about incineration. I think it's possible, but I don't think they're looking to get into the storage business. I think the idea was that they're trying to figure out ways to incinerate this foam.
And that was another of Hudson Mohawk Magazine's ongoing coverage of the Norlite hazardous waste incinerator in Cohoes. And that's just a mile from the Sanctuary for Independent Media here in Troy.
Up next, Eileen Javier talks with Christina Mattern, who is an intern at the Sanctuary for Independent Media and a recent graduate from the College of St. Rose. Congratulations, Christina. Their interview talks about job hunting and graduating during the COVID crisis.
Hello, this is Eileen. Thanks for tuning in to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I am here with Christina Madden. She just recently graduated from the College of St. Rose, majoring in English and Information Technology. She's also an intern at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. How are you today, Christina?
I'm good, Eileen. How are you?
I'm very good, thanks. Can you tell us a little bit about your internship experience at the Sanctuary?
Sure. I did this internship for my English major in college this past semester. And while I was at the Sanctuary, I was the technical and media writing intern, which just meant that I created technical documents like how-to guides, posts for social media, and I worked on the radio segments, posting them to the website and the Facebook page.
You're doing this
remotely?
Yes,
I had to go home. Okay. Yeah, my school closed, and so I had to move back home. So I'm doing everything remotely.
Due to the COVID-19, many colleges and universities have canceled its on-site graduation ceremonies, and they will instead hold online commencement for the spring 2020 graduates. What have the College of St. Rose decided to do with your graduation?
So the College of St. Rose decided to postpone the ceremony completely. They didn't decide to do an online graduation or anything. The ceremony was supposed to be May 9th. But it's been postponed to possibly sometime in September, depending on when everything opens up and a good date for all of the graduates and their families. So the tentative date is September, but not really sure.
Oh, it is a bummer to have this delay, but it makes sense that they moved there for the safety of the students and the families. But I'm glad that you and the other graduates will be able to walk in September 2020, because regardless of the circumstances, this is a lifetime achievement for the class of 2020. So I'm going to be praying that nothing gets moved, and in September 2020, you are there walking in front of your family. Looking forward to that. You're leaving us at the end of May because you found a job. And this is such good news, Christina. What is your new job?
So I will be an associate software developer, and I will be leaving at the end of May because I'll be moving back up to Albany. I'm in Rockland County right now. Mm-hmm. So I'll be moving back up to Albany in June and probably starting my job sometime around then, hopefully.
What do you do? Can you tell us about your job hunting experience during this time?
So I started job hunting around March, which is also coincidentally the same time when COVID got really serious in the area. So everything was completely online. I used LinkedIn and Indeed, and I just searched up keywords that I thought would relate to what job I was looking for. So words like software development, software engineering, technology, technical, even writing sometimes. So from then on, everything was remote. I would get an email from a recruiter requesting a phone interview. And then from then, it was a lot of phone interviews or video call interviews. Nothing was in person for obvious reasons. So it was a little different than I thought my job hunting process would go. Part of me was sort of relieved that it was all online, so I didn't have to worry about going to all these places and trying to figure out how to get there and kind of the nerves that come with meeting people in person like this in an interview setting. But then it was also a little unfortunate because you don't really get to see what that office environment would be or what that company environment would be. It was a little different, but it worked out for me, luckily.
Yes, it did. And do you think that having a major in information technology played a factor for you to find a job on this unprecedented time?
It definitely helped. Whenever you hear someone is an information technology or a computer science major, your first thought is always, oh, it won't be hard to get a job for you, because everyone knows that the industry is really full of positions for people who know about software and technology and programming. So I think it definitely helped me out, especially in that area. There were a lot of open positions, so I wasn't as worried as I would be if I was looking for something that was geared more towards my English major, which I can definitely see having a harder time finding a job for.
Will you be able to work remotely?
I believe I will be able to work remotely. If the office doesn't open up in June, I will most likely be starting remotely. I think that they would be sending me a work laptop so I can join any meetings that we have, possibly do my training online as well. So I'm very fortunate to have a job where I would be able to work online. And so I can start maybe a bit earlier than someone who would have to work on site.
What about all the recent graduates from the College of St. Rose? From the ones that you're in touch, what have been their experience trying to find a job at this time?
It's definitely more frustrating, I think, than they anticipated. With everything moving online, some companies have also been postponing their recruiting process. I talked to a company much earlier in my search who I had a phone interview with. They told me that they would like to move me along the interview process, but that the recruiting process was definitely being postponed until kind of the tail end of this pandemic, which at the moment is very uncertain. So for stuff like that, it was nice to get that experience and have someone say they were going to move my information along, but then also hearing that you don't really know when. So I've spoken to a lot of my friends, and I even spoke to a friend today who was like, I've applied to so many places and I like don't know how many I've applied to so far. I'm kind of losing track of them, because you can apply to 20 or so companies, 5 will get back to you, and of the 5, 3 could be rejection. So it's a very uncertain process, and especially during this time when everyone is at home. You don't have much to do if you're applying all day to these jobs and kind of just sitting there, refreshing your email, refreshing your LinkedIn, seeing if anyone's reached out to you for any interviews or positions. So it's been harder for my friends, definitely. They tell me like, oh, I'm thinking of applying to this position, but I'm not sure if this will work out for me. But I think right now, they're just kind of applying to everything that they see.
What advice would you like to say to other college graduates trying to find a job in this unprecedented time based on your experience?
I would say that it's definitely very intimidating at first. I knew when I started, even before the pandemic got serious in that area, I was looking at job positions, reading all of the skills that they wanted, and just getting kind of like discouraged from applying, because sometimes you'll see a skill on there that you're like, I've never even heard of this. I don't think I should apply to this because I'm not experienced enough or I don't know enough. And I would say that that's not always the case. A lot of the times they just put those skills on there because they're skills that they want you to build up in that position as well. So I think that as I start applying for more jobs and having more interviews, I realized that you don't have to have every skill in there. You don't have to even like have much information about that skill, as long as you show an interest in learning it. And actually during one of my interviews, I asked the interviewer what he thought the most important skill would be for someone like me coming into this position. And he told me that just having the motivation and willingness to learn and grow in that role and in the team was probably the best thing I could bring, because it really is, especially as a college grad, it really is about taking what you learned in college and building that up in experience and just learning, because I don't think that the people who are interviewing you are expecting you to know as much as someone who has been in the industry or in the field as since you are a college grad. They know that you're kind of new to everything. So definitely don't be intimidated. Don't be discouraged. And just do your best. Don't worry too much, because I definitely am guilty of worrying a lot. And, you know, at the end of it, it's kind of like, you know, I shouldn't have worried that much. I just have to be myself.
Anything else that you would like to say?
Sure. I know that this definitely isn't the last semester of my college career that I was hoping for, that I even anticipated. I was hoping that it was going to be fun. I would make a lot of memories with my friends. And obviously, I wasn't expecting to spend my graduation sitting in my room at home and kind of interacting with my friends through Skype, because that's what we did do the night of graduation. We kind of hung out and talked about our experiences. So while I believe that it wasn't the semester that I anticipated, I just made the best of it. And that's really all you can do at the moment. So for everyone who did graduate, I think they should be really proud of what they did, because it definitely wasn't an easy transition, kind of, especially if you did live in a dorm or you lived up there and had to move back home, kind of uprooting your life as it was and moving back home and taking your classes online, taking your finals online, I know was pretty stressful for some people. So I think that it's really important to be proud of what you've done, because it really is amazing.
Yes, it is. Christina, thank you for giving us the gift of your time today. Congratulations on your graduation and best of luck on your new journey. I want pictures for the graduation. Remember that, okay?
Of course. Thank you so much.
And we want to thank Christina for all the great work she did while at the sanctuary. Congratulations, Christina.
And we're going to close out the show with an event happening this weekend. Community leaders in Troy have partnered to bring the community together with a no-cost grab-and-go barbecue that includes free personal protective equipment and a resource fair. We speak with Troy United Event Corps co-organizer Jerry Ford of Team Hero. Welcome to the show, Jerry.
Hey, how you guys doing? It's always a pleasure to, you know, be on with you. Especially at such a time as this, to connect with everybody.
So Team Hero is participating in a huge community event this weekend called Troy United. Can you tell us about this event?
Yes, so Troy United is put on by our brother Kevin Pryor, who has the Troy Look organization. What this is just an event to let the community know that even during these times that we're still there, for them. It's going to be a grab-and-go barbecue down at Detroit Central Little League. And we're going to still, you know, operate by the social distancing guidelines. But we just wanted to let the community know that, you know, we're still here and we're still here to provide for them and support them and show them love.
So the event starts at 2 p.m. at the Troy Little League. You know, will the offerings be for the community at this event?
Definitely. So what we're going to do, we have first and foremost, the grab-and-go barbecue portion, which is going to be a hot dog, a hamburger, some bag of chips, and a drink for everyone. And then on top of that, we're going to be offering a PPE kit, which will contain a mask, hand sanitizer, and gloves, and some information about COVID testing, where to go, and how to get tested if you feel that that's a need of yours.
And will there be other, outreach efforts, you know, on social programs?
Yes. Correct. So we do have partners from a number of different fields here in the city of Troy that will be providing information about their different programs and what resources are still operating under the shadow of the pandemic, that there are other partners that are operating and providing resources also. So they'll be there. There'll be multiple tables that'll be set up where each individual that comes in and is a part of the barbecue would be able to go to and visit those tables, grab information to put inside of their bag, along with that that grab and go lunch.
Can you talk about why this is being held at the North Central Little League?
So, due to social distancing guidelines, we had to find a place that could accommodate what we're trying to do. And, you know, Troy Central Little League has the capacity to do it, but also it's located in an area that we feel often gets neglected or doesn't get, you know, the attention it rightfully deserves, except only on a negative scale. So we wanted to bring something positive. At the Little League, we've been able to secure an entrance. So there'll be one entrance and there'll be one exit. So we'll be able to direct traffic, keep a nice flow so that we are adhering to the social distancing guidelines. So you'll be able to come into the front gate, grab your items, and then exit through a different gate. And Saturday's weather looks to be very, very accommodating. So it'll be a nice time to be outside, to come grab something and keep moving.
Can you talk about, the context of why this event happened in the first place?
Yeah. So as I stated, you know, we want to let the community know that we're still here. And, you know, being shut in or just being, you know, on pause, the whole state being on pause. and everybody's inside and they're doing, you know, very minimal movement. We wanted to let, you know, the community know that, you know, there are people that are still here that are still operating. We have some amazing community partners. We have the FACE Basketball a League for all children everywhere. And, you know, they would at this time regularly, you know, they would be out recruiting for their basketball summer league. And then we have the Firefighters Association. They'll be there and they're doing an amazing job. And Troy, our first responders. We have Leaders Leading Troy Youth, which is the Troy Snug, who are actually doing an event right now in response to some the recent violence that happened over the weekend. Ready Detailing, Ready Enterprise, which is a transportation company, One Troy, and, you know, our Team Hero organization. So we just wanted to make sure that people know that we're still here to support them and assist in any way we can.
So as far as getting food goes, you know, is the food totally free? Is this a community meal? I mean, you can't stay and eat it, of course, but, you know, are you asking anything in return for the barbecue?
Man, as we always do, whenever we put on our events, there's no cost to the community whatsoever. You know, we just ask that everyone adheres to the social distancing guidelines so that, you know, this goes off smooth. We'll be able to go back to the table and see if there's anything else that we can do moving forward. But there is no cost for any of the items, whether it be the food or the PPE kit, there will be no cost whatsoever. We're trying to come up with a few grab bag items also to, make it a little bit enjoyable. So we'll have a few other extra items, which whatever we can come across. But, you know, the main thing will be the grab-and-go lunch and the PPE kit and a few other extra items. But everything is totally free of cost to the public.
So I see on the event poster, it says parents can pick up food for all members of the household. So not everyone need be present to receive the meal.
Yeah. Correct. And once again, that's just trying to keep, you know, the crowd down to a minimum. We're trying to keep the crowd down to a minimum. And so if we have a parent that comes in and they say, I have, you know, X, Y, and Z amount of family members or children, we're asking people to operate under the honor system. So that way you don't have to bring your whole family out and we can keep, keep everything down to a minimum, keep our crowd size under control.
We've been speaking with Jerry Ford of Team Hero here in Troy. They are co-organizing an event called Troy United. It will take place at 2 p.m. on Saturday, May 23rd at the Troy Central Little League, 3130 7th Avenue, Troy, New York. Jerry, thanks for talking with us today.
Can I just add one thing in, Alexis?
Of course.
Okay, and what I want to add is we are encouraging people that come out to wear your mask. So we want you to wear your mask also when you come out. If a family or individual doesn't have a mask, you will be given one at the event in order for you to go in and receive items. You're going to have to put the mask on because, like I said, we are making sure that we're adhering to the social distancing guidelines. And I did forget one community partner, which is Executive Limousines LLC. They're going to be a part of the event also.
All right. Looking forward to it. Thanks, Jerry.
No problem at all. Thank you for allowing me to come and speak about the event.
And that event will take place on Saturday, May 23rd at 2 p.m. at the Troy Central Little League at 3130 7th Avenue in Troy. Please wear a mask to enter the event. And if you don't have a mask, one will be provided. So not every family member need to attend to receive the meal and the PPE. Thanks for coming. And that concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Andrea Cunliffe.
And I'm Alexis Goldsmith. Remember to tune in every weekday to get your daily dose of the hyperlocal news. You can also get that dose on demand through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. If you have comments, suggestions, or want to comment on our work, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org.
And as a reminder, the Hudson Mohawk Magazine is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in joining and helping with our radio efforts, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org or join our weekly virtual Zoom meeting on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m. by sending an email requesting an invitation link to hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Well, until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.